Now I would like to introduce our main speaker for the evening, my friend Margaret.
Hi, I'm an alcoholic and my name's Margaret. I'd really like to extend a warm welcome to the newcomers that are here this evening. And I'd also like to wish Pat and Sue a very happy birthday. Those are very special years, and we're really glad that we got to celebrate them with you. I'd like to thank Randy, who's not here, for inviting me to speak here tonight. And, you know, in the big book, it tells us in our preamble, you know, that we share, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what we're like now. And, you know, like my dear friend always says, nobody ever got here from singing too loud in church. And so nobody asked me to speak here because my life was going along so well. And, you know, they decided to give me a shot. Alcoholics Anonymous has absolutely changed my life. And I am so grateful to be here to share that part, because the truth is that this is a fatal disease. And it's a killing disease. And even though we joke and laugh a lot, this disease takes out a lot of lives. And the good news is we're here tonight, and every person in this room has made a choice not to drink today. And through God's grace and mercy, we're here today. And what it was like, I was born back east in New Jersey. I was one of nine children. I came from a big German-Irish Catholic family. I was number five. There were six girls and three boys. We lived in a small community. And when I was 10 years old, or 11 years old, my father took a job and we moved to Berkeley in 1968. Well, there you go. And that's my story. No. there's more. So we moved to Berkeley, and I'm doing okay there, actually, for the first year. And then we moved to Detroit the year after. And that was when I decided that at 12 years old, I wanted to be like my older sisters, and I wanted to drink like them. And so I started drinking beer. And, you know, the thing that drew me to the beer was because I wanted to be like them. I wanted to look like them. I wanted to emulate what they were doing. Would have been great if they were, you know, really studying something. But we were all on a roll, and that's the way it went. And so that's when my drinking began. I would start to take beer out of the refrigerator, and pretty soon, when it says we're a liar, thief, and a chief, you know, here comes the lying, taking the beer that wasn't mine, hiding it up in my bedroom, and then I'd have this little transistor radio, and I'd just plug it in and play these sad songs because we had moved and I didn't have any friends, and I'd just drink this warm beer, and, you know, I just used to really get into those sad, sappy songs, you know. And so, and that's, I was 12. So I didn't get sober until I was 31, and I'm 50 now. So I'm telling you, the thing goes a while. And so that was how it started. It was just these little, you know, these little increments of drinking. And then we moved to Maryland, and I started to surround myself with kids that were, you know, they always say the word partying, you know. Actually, it was just we were getting drunk. And, you know, I mean, you dress this thing up in 900 different ways. And the bottom line is I drank for the effect after a while. And once that effect became clear, it was almost, you know, just in no time at all. I was about 13 when I drank the hard liquor. We were at this church function. Yeah, and my sister was making these whiskey sours, and so I started throwing a few of those back, and pretty soon I was in a complete blackout. And I remember vaguely driving home in the station wagon, because they had my head out the window, and I was throwing up, and my hair was doing this, and when I came to the next morning, it was about 4 in the morning, I had this really beautiful velvet dress on that I had made with a neighbor. and it was just trashed. And my hair looked like Bride of Frankenstein because all the wind was in it and the puke was in it. And it was just... Now, you'd think that would make somebody stop drinking. However, I washed myself up and I got scared. I remember in that moment getting really afraid because the commercials on television had come out and they were lighting a candle and saying, I'm an alcoholic. And I knew my grandfather was a very serious alcoholic because the family would talk about how Grandpa used to drink. And unfortunately, my grandfather never did come to Alcoholics Anonymous. He was a doctor back in New York, and he was afraid that his career would be dampened. And, you know, when you start looking at that and you think, gosh, you know, he used to be out drinking all night, and then he'd shoot himself up with morphine to get to work. And you think about that compared to going to a meeting. You know, I think about the struggle that we give ourselves, or we can just come and sit down and have a little coffee and read this book. And anyway, so that was my very first blackout. And, you know, in those times, you know, I remember my parents going, you're never going to do this, and you're grounded. And I think that whole summer I was grounded for everything. I was really getting into some other things. And so eventually we moved again. However, all these people that I started to become friends with were starting to pick up alcohol, and we were going to school, you know, drunk in the eighth grade. And that's how it started. It was like that was the way I could reach out to these people who were new. I was just so twisted so young, at such a young point, about thinking about how things would work for me. And so as I kept going through my school years, the drinking would always be a part of it. I started swimming on the swim team, and I thought, you know, I'm going to clean up my act. I was 15, and I was just going to swim on the swim team and be a better person. And it worked for a while. And then I started to go to work. We moved to Monterey, and I worked on Fisherman's Wharf. And you know, all the gals would get off work, and they'd say, come on, you know, we're going to take you out for a drink. You did a great job tonight. I was 16. I was like, oh, okay. Pretty soon I'm drinking at the bars. And I was tall, so everybody bought it that I was, I don't know how anybody thought I was 21, but I think they just looked the other way. And so the drinking continued there. And when I was in high school, my senior year, I met a young man and became involved with him. And when that relationship broke up, I started to do some serious drinking because I didn't like how I felt. And I couldn't cope with the sadness or the loss. And so I drank more. And, you know, in our book, it talks to us about the fatal progression of this disease. And for the newcomers, this is that book I'm talking about. It's called The Big Book. This really does look big because it's got big print, too. But there's a lot of these. If you don't have one of these books, really, it's like don't take a Spanish class and buy the book. This is a have-to book. And so my drinking just started to really, I mean, the blackouts were all the time, and I'd struggle with it. People would tell me what had happened. I couldn't remember where I'd leave my car. I couldn't remember where I'd leave my clothes. I couldn't remember, you know. And, you know, when that split up happened, I remember thinking, you know, all bets are off now. I'm just gonna go out there and take off, and that's what I did. And I ran hard, and I worked in the restaurant business for a long time. I worked in places that Jim would go. Jim would have been one of our greatest customers because he bought the house. Would always be buying drinks for everybody. And you know, working there, you know, in my teens and 20s, I never made it to college because I was too busy having fun. And you know, I would see these really successful guys come in, and they had their three-piece suits on, and they were, you know, buying all these things, and they had big companies, and they always bought drinks for us, always. And so pretty soon, my lifestyle got really, really racy, and I was just trying to piece getting together so I could show up at work, and most of the times we drank at work, so... there wasn't a lot of clear time during this time in my 20s. And while all this was going on, when I was 23, I got pregnant. And I had been on a roll for quite a bit, and so it just brought me up short, and I thought, you know something, I need to change. And I chose to keep that baby, and I cleaned up as best as I could. And when she came out, I tried to get a dad in place for her and tried to get things in motion, and that worked for a little while. And then the drinking just continued because the guy that was in place was a bartender. So that's how that goes. And so, you know, my life ran like that. It was the restaurant work. It was late parties, all-nighters. It was things like that. Going out, you know, with a group of people, ending up, you didn't know who you were with, who was there, where your car was, you know, all those kinds of fun things that we do when our drinking becomes out of control. And the thing that's important is, you know, it's not, people say, well, I only had one drink. And for me, what I really have come to understand and know is that it's the first sip. It's the first sip, because that stuff goes down and it ignites in me and it takes off like petrol. And then I'm off. And at that point, I don't know how many more I'm going to have. I don't know if I'm going to have one or 1,000. And I don't know where I'm going to end up, or, you know, I might not do anything, or I might take off and go to Tijuana. I mean, it's such an unpredictable lifestyle. And here was this little girl, and I was trying to raise her as best as I could, and I was on my own, and I didn't have a lot of family support because they thought I was pretty out there, and I was. And so when she got to be about 7 years old, I was living over here in San Carlos, and I remember coming to one morning, and there were many times I had thought, I've got to stop, and you know, each time I would think that, it never occurred to me to stop the drinking. It was always like, I got to get a new job. I got to get a new guy. You know, I got to do something new. And it never occurred to me that the alcohol was what was fueling all this stuff. And then slowly but surely, you know, I'd have these moments like when I was 14 and I'd think, am I an alcoholic? You know, am I going to have to stop drinking forever? You know, where am I going to work? How am I going to function? And I never thought about the fact that I was probably going to maybe get better and maybe my life would get better. I never could take that kind of thinking any further, because I was so surrounded in just keeping this insanity. It was just all there. And so little by little, God would always plant people in my path, as he always does. You know, if I look back, there were many, many opportunities for me to come into this program. By members in this program. And, you know, we'd watch people in the bar business, you know, they'd get pulled over with DUIs, and I had two of those. And we get pulled, you know, I remember my first DUI was in 78 or 80, somewhere in there. And, you know, everybody, I was mortified by this thing. And everybody's like, oh, you got one of those? No problem. Just do this. Just throw a little money at it. You'll be all right. In those days, it was $300. And they never looked back at it. It was just like, okay, well, don't do it anymore, you know. And they kind of, everybody would laugh about it. It was kind of a joke. But there was a part of me that was just like, oh my gosh, something's really wrong here. Well, then when about 1986, I got another one. And the first one I was 2.4, and the second one I was 2.8. And that was the first time that the court, the gal, you know, they had a counselor that would talk to you, and she'd say, you know, do you have a problem with alcohol? And I looked her right in the face, and I go, you know, I'm just stressed out. I just have all these people in my life that stress me out. They go away, I'd be better. And she's like, okay. Writes it down. And, yeah, I'm sure she heard that a few times. And so anyway, So I remember thinking, I hope they send me those AA meetings. I hope they send me the AA meetings. And you know, at the time, I don't know why I didn't think, why don't I just go to one? You know what I mean? Like I was another one of those thoughts, like, well, why don't you just go? I'll wait till the judge sends me because he's smarter than me. And, you know, so here I am. And then and he doesn't send me to, you know, because my attorney didn't show up. And the guy goes, you know, your attorney's ditched you twice. You know, I go, I paid him. I don't know why he's not here. And so I go, you know, whatever you got to do, just do it. You know, just whatever you got to do. And he goes, you know, I think you just ought to stop drinking. You'll be all right. And that was it. And so I went, oh, okay. And I was scared for a while then. And they suspended my license. And my thinking was, once again, this is that thinking that got me here. It was like, well, they suspended my license, but they didn't take it. Because I still had it. You know? It's like, these guys are really, you know, what's with these guys? You know? It's like, so I thought I was smarter than them. So I kept driving. And, you know, That was, you know, I'm telling you, there is a higher power. Just in case you're new and you think there isn't a God or a higher power, trust me, there is one. And so I'm driving around with no license, and I don't think I have insurance because I don't even think then you needed insurance. And, you know, it's just that crazy lifestyle. And here's this little kid growing up watching all this stuff. And when she was about 7 years old, you know, my drinking really escalated actually in 1986, after the DUI, one of my brothers committed suicide. And it was just devastating. And my drinking went from bad drinking to that chronic fatal progression where I needed to drink every single day because when those feelings would come up, I couldn't even breathe. God rest his soul. And, you know, I'll tell you, his passing pushed me to have to look at who I was. And he was only 26 years old. And I just couldn't shake it. I couldn't shake why he left here that way. So I just kept drinking more and more. And it was the kind of drinking where I just drank so I could, because I would start to breathe and the panic would hit me and I'd just suck them up. And after a while, it just stopped working. And there was a neighbor that was in our neighborhood. We lived in this complex over here off Bell Bluff, and I'm telling you, everybody in the complex had been thrown to the curb by their guys. Everybody. I mean, we had tons of kids, no child support, and we had each other. It was the greatest neighborhood. And half of us were in recovery, and the other half were trying to get there. And I was moving out from this boyfriend who was my daughter's dad. And I'm moving out one more time, you know. Remember one guy used to always say, oh, you're doing those suitcase drills. And I was moving out one more time, and I had put a deposit on this place over in Spring Valley, and all of a sudden my car just turned. And I'd always wondered what was at the end of this block, and it was a little cul-de-sac. And I look up, and there's a friend sign, and I knock on the door, and the guy rents this place to me. I mean, it was the nuttiest thing. And I mean, it was such God's plan. I mean, I couldn't believe it. And here I'm still drinking, and I had this job. I was in the restaurant business for years and years, and I thought, you know, I'm going to go work at the hospital. That'll help me, and I'll get better. I should have been in the hospital, but I thought if I worked there, maybe it'd rub off. I don't know. So I go to work at this at Grossmont Hospital, and that didn't last very long because you had to go every day. And, I mean, when you're in the restaurant business, you know, you just doll up, you wear these short skirts, everybody goes, oh, they look cute, you know, in the restaurant, in the hospital, you know, you just wear this, you know, funky garb, and you have to be there at 5 o'clock in the morning, and it was like, oh my gosh, I have to do this tomorrow too. So it was a tough job. And you know, no money. You know, they gave you minimum wage or something. And so I was like, oh, this isn't going to work. So I kept looking, you know, and I kept trying to change my life so that I'd get better. So finally I go and I see this therapist. She leaves it. I start having panic attacks. And they're so bad that, I can't even breathe. I'm doubled over. I can't get off the couch. And I'm thinking, they were so bad that I went, I better do something. You know, that's what my body did. It finally just said, that's it, you're done. So I go to see this therapist, and she lived right up the street. And And she just says, you know, she asked me a few things, and she's like, her eyes are kind of doing this. And I go, so is that it? Am I all done now? I'm going home. Am I better? And she goes, no, I think I want you to come back. And she saw me for free for the first year. She just said, you need to come here. And she said, finally, after a few months, she said, you know what? You need to go to AA, and you need to go to meetings. And I was like, why? Why do you think? And she said, because if you want to do this work, you need to get sober. And I had no insurance, so there wasn't any, you know, rehab kind of thing. I didn't know about, I never thought to call Alcoholics Anonymous, so what do I do? Or, you know, it was like I just went, okay, well, I'll look for a schedule. And so in the meantime, I move into this neighborhood, and this neighbor has 6 months of sobriety. And she's talking to me one afternoon, and she leaves a schedule on my table. She goes, you know, if you know anybody that needs to use this program, just give it to them. And I'm looking at her, and I'm drinking, and I go, oh, yeah. I think I do know somebody. I have a lot of friends in the restaurant business who really use this. So she leaves the schedule, and I'm like waiting for her to leave so I can read it and see what it means, you know, because I have no idea what's going on. So I look in the book, and my therapist, who's just this great gal, she says, you know, this is the deal, Margaret. You know, some people drink coffee and cigarettes. And she said, you know, you like to drink and visit men. So I want you to go to women's meetings for the first year. And I went, really? So I looked up the women's meeting, and I'd go up to it was at St. Dunstan's. A Tuesday at night, 6:30, and I go up there and I'd sit in the parking lot with a big thing of wine and I go, okay, I know I can get her on time. I'll try it next week. And I'd turn my car around, and she gave me a deadline, and she goes, look, by August, you know, you're eating her. So the week before she's giving me the boot, I go to this meeting. And let me tell you, there were 7 women in that meeting, and they were kind and thoughtful and loving and open, and they cared about me, and I knew it. They weren't just, you know, putting it out there. It wasn't a shuck and jive. They really sincerely cared about me. And so they said, you know, you just don't drink, and you'll be all right. You know, come to another meeting. And so I go, I'll go once a week. They said, there's a lot of meetings in there, you know, and so I waffled a lot in the beginning. And eventually, you know, they talk about this in our book, and it says, you know, when we read that part and more about alcoholism, if you're a newcomer, the chapter that he reads, you know, there's chapters in here in this book, and there's a chapter called More About Alcoholism. You read that because, you know, you can only read like 2 sentences, because then you go, what does that mean? Because it's big, and this book is designed to be read with somebody. So, you know, get yourself a sponsor. There's a lot of really great people with a lot of good time in this meeting, and work through, you know, the steps and read this book, because it'll really explain a lot about what's going on in your life. And because I used to think I could figure it out, and I don't do that anymore because that's dangerous. So I go to this meeting, and the gals there are just super, and they're like, you know, keep coming back. And so eventually, you know, I got to a place where I had gotten up one morning, and I had this gigantic bruise on my leg, and I couldn't remember how I got it. And I remember the look on my daughter's face. I had never seen her look at me like that before. And I went, that's it. I am done drinking. And I went to that Saturday morning meeting, and it was a La Mesa Women's. It was over in the NRC. I don't even think the NRC is there anymore. And I walked in that meeting, and I mean, I raised my hand as a newcomer. I got there on time because I used to like to come late and not raise my hand. And I really admire the people in here tonight that stood up and shared that they were new, because that's a scary thing to do in a big place like this. I mean, I went to those little meetings where, you know, go, yeah, me. And that's a really important thing to do, because that was a turning point for me about getting honest with myself and with others. You know, and when we talk about step five, where it says we talked, you know, it's we have to write, you know, certain things down. It's, you know, to ourselves, to God, and to another human being. I mean, we have to begin to get honest, and the way to practice that is by saying, you know, I have less than 30 days. It's not to embarrass you. It's not to hurt you in any way. It's to embrace. It gives the group a chance to embrace you, so they can they know you're new and you might need some guidance or some phone numbers. You know, when I was new, I didn't know what the phone list was about. I thought it was, you know, a social thing. And there's a deal, and it says, you know what? You pick up the phone instead of a drink. And you call anybody on that phone list when you feel like drinking or you just feel like crap. And you pick up the phone and you don't say, hi, what are you doing? You go, hi, I feel like crap. Can I talk? And pretty soon, you know, you start to get better. And it's those little things. There's tons of them in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's tons of tools that we use to stay sober. So I go to this meeting and I'm hanging my head low and I'm dying because I feel like I'm so hung chow. And I remembered one of these gals came over with my to my house that the night before, and she says, you know, hey, I got some wine, you know. And I remember that part in the reading where it says, and if some of you can drink like a gentleman, our hats are off to you. And I remembered that part, and I was like, well, maybe they're going to take their hats off. Maybe I could try it just one more time. Nobody took their hat off, and I wound up back at a meeting. And thank God for that. And so I came into Alcoholics Anonymous at that point, and I'm like, I got a sponsor. I'm like, okay, what book do I buy? Because I was like, how much is it? It was big books for $3 then. $3 for a whole book? And there's no picture in it. You know, I mean, it was like, you know, it was like, what's this about? And so, you know, there's the 12 and 12s are there. I mean, all the literature on that table, it's all, you know, conference approved. So those one day at a time, the bills, as Bill sees it, all those great reads on our book table. And so I start coming to meetings and I get a sponsor. And I go, you know what? I don't know what these steps are. You know, I remember when I first came into the meeting and the steps were up on the wall like that. And I go, okay, one, I'm powerless. Yeah, okay. Next, my lifestyle manager. Okay. All right. Came to believe I was insane. Yeah, okay, next. You know, and I thought, okay, I'm on step 10. And the meeting wasn't even over yet. Because, you know, I just wanted to get it. You know, I was just ready. And that's not how it works. Just to let you know. However, you can think like that, and it still works, because the people that come here that will guide you through these steps are more than happy to, you know, share that with you. And because that's how we stay sober. You know, somebody took the time to sponsor me, and that's a great gift. So I meet the sponsor, and she's a great gal, and she's got 2 years, and I think she's ancient. And so we're getting ready to do step four, and she's going to move to New York. And I'm thinking, well, she can't do that because we're only on step four. So somebody better call God fast. She goes, Margaret, you're going to have to get another sponsor. And I was devastated. I was like, another one? How can I do that? It took me months to ask you. And she's like, it'll all work out. You're going to do fine. And so I got another sponsor and worked through step four and step five and step six and seven and took them in order. And, you know, my life scratched the surface, you know, the first time through the steps. It scratches the surface because I didn't get that sick overnight. And taking the steps in my first year, you know, it was a great start. But this is something that I have to continue with. I just celebrated 19 years in December. I actually got sober on my mother's birthday. Isn't that amazing? Just blows me away. And, it, you know, like, I didn't plan that. So although I would, you know, think, oh, I'll get sober then. But that's not how it worked. And, you know, that's a great gift for me today to be able to do that, because in my early sobriety, there was such damage in my family that I didn't speak to any brothers or sisters for the first 4 years of my sobriety. And it was a very challenging and lonely time because there was a lot of change that was involved. And that little girl, I wound up, you know, taking her to a lot of these meetings. There used to be a Friday night book study that we used to go to all the time. And she used to color the birthday cards for people. And, you know, I love seeing kids I love seeing kids in meetings because, you know what, it got me there. And you know, I remember my sponsor used to say, you know, they're the sounds of life. So if they aggravate people, they need to learn how to listen to the sounds of life. And so anyway, when I first got sober, I started working for myself. I kind of invented this job, and I still have it. And I kept thinking, you know, someday I'm going to have a big, real job. And I guess God has his own plans. And you know, that's how it works for me. I have to take instruction from a power greater than me. I wasn't doing a hot job doing it my way. And I can tell you from the bottom of my heart that, you know, staying sober for 19 years, each day, there is still a decision that I make every morning when I thank God for keeping me sober in the morning on my knees. There is still an evening before I retire that I, you know, have to inventory what my day was like and take a look at those things and see where I need to either mend fences or just be quiet sometimes. And I think working this program and my family is the biggest challenge I have. You know, I eventually met somebody in this program, and I got married when I was 38. And when I was just about 40, I had a son. And so what a great gift in my life to have an opportunity to raise a young man sober. He's going to be 11 in March. And I'll tell you what, this husband of mine, I am a much better person because of this program and his presence in my life in a really big way. He has pushed me. You know, a lot of times when we're at the beach and I see the shoreline, and you know how, especially down at Sunset Cliffs, when the shore is just, you see all those colors in the rocks, and they're molded a certain way, and it took a long time and a lot of pounding on that ocean, you know, but there's something beautiful there. And that's a lot like how my marriage is. You know, there's been a lot of pounding with getting rid of old ideas. For me, you know, I have got to get rid of these old ideas. And I've had to reach out and deepen my program. In our book, it talks about broadening and deepening our path. Broaden and deepen. And my sponsor is going to be, she'll be sober 37 years here coming up in August. And I just talked to her the other day on the phone, and she said, you know what, Margaret, it's still about going deeper. It's still about going deeper. When I get uncomfortable, when I feel like I can't take another breath in, when I don't want to do something, she told me something very important once. She said, you know what, Margaret, experience is what you get when you don't get what you want. And I have a lot of experience, a lot, and it comes earnestly. And you know what? It's people like that that teach me these things, because you know something? It says, as we trudge the road to happy destiny, it never says skip or jump or, you know, frolic. It says trudge, man. It is trudging this happy road, right? Am I right, Mr. Bob? I'm telling you. It is trudging this road, and you know what? When I'm trudging, if it wasn't for my neighbor here, who's going to be sober 40 years here in August, I would be like, SOS, what's going on here? I mean, life is too big for me to, you know, to try to put it all together, and so I have to keep it in 24-hour increments. You know, when Randy asked me to do this commitment a few months ago, I was really in a dark place, and my sponsor said, it's time to go deeper. And I said, okay, I'm going to up my commitments. And then Randy goes, can you be a speaker? And I went, yeah. And then it was months ago. And then like 2 weeks ago, he goes, hey, Margaret, remember that commitment? I went, did I say I would do that? Okay. And Susie, you sure you don't want to do that? Feeling better now. And you know what? The reason that I'm feeling better is because I jumped up my service work. And that's really important when you're in this program for a while. Get a commitment. New people, be a coffee person. It's the greatest thing. We just read a story in the back of the big book. Another thing that's great, too, if you're new, and even it doesn't matter how old you are, we have these stories in the back of the big book. And let me tell you something. They saved me so many times. I just went up to see my in-laws, and I was just in a really dark place. And I picked up that big book and read the story, The Tightrope. We just read it Thursday. And let me tell you something. That person's experience, strength, and hope sinks in. And suddenly, I don't feel alone. I can identify with their feelings. I'm walking through that, wow, it was crappy, and now it's better. And you know what? I start thinking better. My stinking thinking evaporates, and I start to feel better. Because that's the thing. The steps are going to rearrange how I think and perceive things. Many times I've heard this is a disease of perception, and that's because it is. How I look at things. When I'm in that dark hole, everything can look dark. And you take a little commitment, and the next thing you know what? Your focus is on something else. It's on something better. It's something outside of me. I'm not sitting in there just focusing on what's happening now. I'm getting more experience because I'm not getting what I want, you know. It's like, oh, okay, you know. I do that a lot. And I'll tell you, this is a great place to grow. If you've come here, there are no mistakes. You know, when people come in with court slips and we just go, you know what? Nobody ever thought, somebody thinks you got something going. You got a court slip. You know, Joe Schmo next door doesn't have one, and I could have had 3 million of them. I mean, the way I lived, I could have had a court slip every half hour. And, because that is the way that I lived. And it's just true. I mean, there's just so many things about my life that I just didn't have the thinking. I didn't have a guideline. I didn't have a place in life. And I bring this program everywhere I go. I bring this program when I go to church. I bring it, because I remember when I first went back to church and I was like, oh, here that, because it says in the book, check it out sometimes. And so I'm like, okay, I'm checking it out. And I start, then I start getting that thinking going like, oh, look at it. Well, he thinks he's, and my head starts going, right? And then I remember, one of the guys in our Sunday group, he said, hey, you know what? When you're in a new place and you start thinking like that, you reach out to three people. And immediately, I just lean to the guy, the usher, and I go, hi, I'm Margaret. And he goes, shh. Sorry about that. And then I didn't care. I was on a roll. And I went, okay, I got three people, man, So I walked out to the coffee maker and I said, hey, thank you for making coffee today. And he goes, wow, nobody ever thanks me. Thank you. Here's have a cup. And, pretty soon people, and then next time I saw the usher, he goes, hey, hi, how are you? And I go, I'm good. Can I talk to you now? And, it was like, it was okay. And, all these little skills. I learned them here. You want to be a coffee person? I made awful coffee. People were like, read the directions. Somebody would be kind enough and say, hey, Mario, come here a minute. There's instructions on here. And I go, oh, there's instructions again. I just want to eyeball it, when I hang curtains, I want to eyeball it. My husband's like, no, get out the measurement. So, little by little, it gives us a way of life that, is positive. And we come from the, these dregs of, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, we are so bankrupt and so checked out. And you know something? It's not just that's happening to us, because my daughter watched that. She watched the effects of this illness. And she was afraid a lot of the times. And she was scared. And she didn't understand things. Because when you're little, you can only see this far. You can't look around this way. So when she got, a little bit older, she got into some 12-step group. And, she's 26 now. And I'm telling you, there isn't a day that goes by that I'm not grateful for being able to reach out to the gals who are getting sober now that have kids. Because I know what that's like to be a drunk mom. I know the shame and the guilt and just that desperation. I know that. And yet today, like it tells me in the book, don't close the door on those things. Don't close the door on the past. It's going to be the key. And the how of this program, honesty, open-mindedness, willingness. I used to really sincerely think I was open-minded, okay? That is not true. I mean, it was just like, as long as it was going my way, I was open-minded. As long as you were agreeing with me, I was there. And I used to think I was flexible. so not. And I used to think I was honest until somebody said, well, how many things did you take? Was it yours? And I'd be like, well, no, but they had so many, I didn't think they'd notice. You know, and that's what the inventory work helps. You know, it's like, okay, so was it yours? I remember this one guy that said he had this 9-step to do, and his sponsor's like, okay, so you got to pay this guy back. And the guy goes, oh, you know. And he goes, look, you don't have to pay him back your money. He just wants his money. You know, and I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. You know, it puts a whole other spin on it, you know. It's like, that's right. So those financial amends are important. And another thing that I want to share that's important, oh, wow, it's 5 to 9. I'm almost done. Okay. One more quick thing. Sexual inventory. You know, resentments, fears, and sexual inventory. That sexual inventory has so saved my life and helped me to develop and grow into a healthier, better sexual life with my husband. And I'm eternally grateful for that. I just want to thank you for listening and thank you for coming. And I think I'm done. Okay.